satt seg i ambulansen, hadde hun akkurat de samme symptomene, hadde afasi, hadde høyre side i parese, klarte ikke å gå, klarte ikke å snakke. Når hun gikk ut av ambulansen på Ullevål, så gikk hun ut selv. Og det var den tiden det tok etter vi ga trombolyse, som gjorde at hun, den blodproppen hennes ble borte, og at hun fikk tilbake funksjon, og hun fikk ingen sekeller. Hun lever fortsatt akkurat som hun gjorde. Det er det vi er ute etter, og det er det vi er ute etter, og det er det som er viktig med det her. Så, takk for meg. Hvis det er noen som har noen spørsmål eller noe sånt, så får dere bare komme ned. Dere får, hvis dere ikke har fått det enda, så får dere det etterpå også.
Now it's on, yeah. Okay, music next door has stopped, so I guess that's our cue to start. Let me see, where is the presentation? There. Yeah, today we'll continue in crypto, on crypto, whatever. Last week we said something about the history of crypto and some historical classical crypto systems, and an assignment on that. Today we'll focus on the symmetric crypto. Yeah. Symmetric crypto, yeah? Sure. This class is streamed. Vorlesing. It is public. I sent out a message this morning. You should check your email. You got a message this morning. Why, if it's streamed, you're not coming? No. Then I'm not streaming anymore. It is streamed. All classes will be streamed, will be recorded from now on. Only the first week, we didn't have a room where that was available. But now it's available, so I'll do that. Yeah. If you go to... also, for the recording, you have to go to... I hope that this is readable. If you go to this link, then you will be able to see that. And if you forget, it's on the streaming, but that's too late then. Okay, back to symmetric crypto today. Symmetric actually comes from the fact that the key that is used by the sender and the receiver is the same. So that's the symmetry. So the encryption and decryption key are the same. The encryption and decryption algorithm, then by default, are different or can be different, are not always different. There's obviously they are related. Yeah, if I go one way with the encryption, decryption goes the other way. So the algorithms are very much related anyway. So as said, user and receiver have to have the same key. And so that key should also be secret. Because if that key is known, then anybody who has that key can do exactly the same as the legitimate sender and receiver. And so we don't want that. But key distribution now becomes a problem. If I want to talk to you, we have to have a key. If I want to talk to you, we have to have a key. And that should be different keys. And how do I get these keys to you? Some examples. DES, long time used, or variations of DES. AES, the A51 algorithm, or the alleged A51 algorithm in the GSM. All examples of symmetric keys, crypto systems. But to really explain what symmetric crypto is, I'll do the following. I'll have an example. I will share keys with different persons. And the key is a dictionary. I have a number of dictionaries here, so I have a lot of keys. I will not use all of them. I'll use 5 of them. And I want to share... let me see, this is for Alice. I want to share a key with Alice. And today you can be Alice. Or Shigu. I'm actually missing Carol. I want to share a key with Bob also. Who wants to be Bob? You want to be Bob? Bob. That's your key. See, it's a different key. We have now a different key. And you see that the problem with the key distribution, I have to walk all of the time. Then I want to share a key with Carol. Were you German? Yeah? You get the German dictionary. Probably you don't need it anyway. Let's see. I need 2 more people. I need Dave. Dave, you can be Dave. Dave gets a Dutch dictionary, and then who wants to play Eve? You'll be Eve. Yeah. Don't be evil and watch in his dictionary. Don't do that. Don't steal keys. Okay, so the way that you use your key now is the following. I want to share a message with Alice. And so I came up with a Norwegian word. And I translated that. I have the same keys as you because it's a symmetric key system. I have the same keys. And so what I did is I wanted to share a word with her. And I looked up in the key, in the dictionary that we share, and I looked up that word. And that's a word I will give you in a second. Can go one step further. Yeah, and then the trick is that this is not a Norwegian word, so some of you have Norwegian-German and German-Norwegian word, but yeah, you have to look in the German-Norwegian dictionary part, and you are Dutch, right? Yeah, look in the Dutch-Norwegian part. Yeah, and so I'm giving you a word that I want to share with Alice, and Alice will be able to see what I want to tell to her, but all the other ones can't. So here is the word. And because my language issues are, or my language is not that good, let me see. That is the word. Did you manage that? Okay. Yeah? So you can look it up. But at first, before you say anything, yeah, so everybody can try that. Yeah, you want to know what I want to say to Alice. So Bob, where's Bob? Bob. Okay, what am I telling her? Is that word, can you use your key to figure out what this means? Well, you never know. Huh? There's Carol. Bob, look on page 149. I did some homework. There it should be. If you can decrypt it with your key, it should be on page 149. Anything? No? Okay. That's good. At least it's still a secret. But let's see what Carol says. It's not there either. It's not on page 574. That's where it should be. How about Dave? Dave. No? Not a Dutch word? Eve. Also not. All right, then Alice. Security. Nein. Sikkerhet. It was a Norwegian word, right? Sikkerhet. If I could have told you secret, all of you, yeah, but then I would have used a different kind of encoding. Yeah, so if I wanted to say security to you, you are Bob, I would have used that Turkish word that I don't dare to pronounce. Yeah, I can pronounce the Dutch one, veiligheid. Have some pre-knowledge there. Yeah, so this is the basic idea behind symmetric crypto. We share a key. And using that key, I can communicate with you, but nobody else can understand it. Even if they have their own key, I share different keys with different persons. And if I want to talk to one of you, I use that particular key. And so that's the basic idea about symmetric crypto. Any questions? Okay, then that's it. No, it's not it for today. Let's go and look at a number of different ways that we can do symmetric encryption. There are actually two major systems. There are stream ciphers and there is block ciphers. So first, stream cipher. A stream cipher means that actually I have a stream of bits that I'm encrypting, and I'm encrypting them bit by bit. So I see a new plaintext bit, bam, I encrypt it with a key, next one. So an encryption algorithm simply is the XOR algorithm. I see a plaintext bit, I take a key bit, and I XOR them, and that's my ciphertext bit. Yeah, that's me doing as a sender. This receiver has to do it the other way around. It sees the ciphertext bit and adds the plaintext bit, XORs the key bit, and then the result will be the plaintext bit. And obviously, we hope that what the sender sees is the same. Assume that we have the same key, symmetric key, right? Yeah. You can easily check that. So PI prime is in fact the same as PI. Very simple mathematics. I will not go into details. So obviously, I share this stream of key bits with somebody. But that should be secret. So it should not be a string of all ones. Yeah, that's easy to guess. Or all zeros. Or whatever. Yeah. So it should be some kind of a random string of bits. But I should be able to generate that, and then the receiver should be able to generate that. So a string of completely random bits is rather out of the question. We cannot. I can generate a string of completely random bits, but then the receiver has to have the same stream. So there we have a problem. But we can generate what is called a random-looking string using a linear feedback shift register. And what is a linear feedback shift register? We'll get to that in the next slide. But that device that will generate something that looks random. It's not random. It's deterministic. But given the same settings, same initial settings, I can generate the same stream as the other person. The way that we check randomness is that's a bit later. So here is an example of a linear feedback shift register. This is a linear feedback shift register, LFSR, of length 7. Why 7? Because there are 7 of these blocks. And in each block, there is a bit, 0 or 1. And then we say that the LFSR steps. In every step, one bit will be pushed out to the right in this particular case. The content will shift one position, and there will be a new bit in the leftmost position in this case. Yeah, you'll see that sometimes the bits fall out on the left side, sometimes on the right side, but you'll see that from the picture. And in this case, the bit that enters at the left side is actually a combination of this bit and this bit and this bit. Why? From here, I see a line going out. From here, I see a line going out. And actually, from the last one, the line is also going out. Yeah, those three bits will be combined. So as an example, here we have a particular filling of this LFSR, 10101110. And let's see what happens at a step of the linear feedback shift register. So the first step, as I said, the rightmost bit in this case is pushed out. So the output bit, the key bit, will be a 0. Then I have to calculate what will be entering on the left side. Well, a 1 and a 1 and a 0 are being pushed out. So a 0 at the right-hand side and a 1 in the middle. Together that will be, if I XOR them, that will be a 1 again. And then the original leftmost bit was a 1, 2. And so I XOR that with the 1 I just got. And so that means a 0 will be entering. So I first push through these bits to the right-hand side. The 0 has already dropped out, so forget about that. But the content 101011, that will shift one bit to the right. And then the new bit, the 0, will enter. And there I have the new filling. So one step of this LFSR gave me new content of the LFSR and an output bit of 0. Yeah, there it is. Is this completely new to everybody? Somebody seen that before? Let's practice a bit with that. We'll not go do all of these, but assume that we have the same LFSR and look at a particular content, 110101, and make 3 steps and then see what the output bits are and what the content is after these 3 steps. Yeah, go ahead and try, and then in a minute I'll show you. Let's see what happens. First step. So this is the content, and I underline the feedback bits. First step, the one will be outputted. All these bits will shift one position. And actually, this one and this one and this one are XORed together. One XOR, one XOR, one is one. That will be entering here. Second step, zero is pushed out. Everything shifts once, position, 1 1 0 1 1, and then a zero, a one, and a one are XORed and enter here. Next step, one is being pushed out. Everything shifts one position, and a one, a zero, and a zero are XORed together. Yeah, so after three steps, the content is 1 0 1 1 1 0 1, and the output is 1 0 1. This output, 1 0 1, is actually 1 0 1. Next output bit would have been a 1 and a 0 and a 1 and a 1, etc. I'll skip these two. You can have a look at them later. Here I said, what if the content is all zeros? And I'll step it 33 times.
That's a lot of work.
Let's step it one time first. So the content is zero. Let's see what happens. Well, we push out the zero. That's easy. We shift everything one position. And one, and then we XOR a zero, a zero, and a zero. Well, that's rather zero again. So actually, I'm in the same situation. I output a zero, and the content doesn't change. And actually, it will always be that. So in this case, doesn't matter how many steps I take, the content will always be all zeros, and I will just output zeros. So obviously, if I'm using an LFSR to do key bit generation, I shouldn't start with the all zero content. Yeah, that's a bit silly. Yeah, try the other two examples at home and see if you manage. Let's formalize things a bit. Here is a feedback shift register again. I don't say linear feedback shift register. I say a feedback shift register this time because it's more general. The function F on the top, that is actually providing the feedback. That doesn't need to be a linear function. Can be, but it doesn't need to be. Yeah. See now that the output is all of a sudden on the left-hand side. So I just turned everything around, and there are now arrows between all these boxes. But forget about that. That's not important. Yeah, I hope that you can all see what's going on here. So I have a filling of these boxes, S0 up to Sn minus 1. At each step, S0 is pushed out. S1 up to Sn minus 1 is pushed, in this case, to the left. And the original S0 up to Sn minus 1, those are used as input to some kind of function F. And the output to that function is a bit, 0, 1, and that is pushed in on the rightmost position again. If the function was linear, and it's all of a sudden called a linear feedback shift register again. What's a linear function? Well, in terms of bits, I take I take C0 times S0, so the content of the first block, times some C0, C0, 0, 1, XOR C1 times S1, XOR, etc., etc., all the way to the end. Yeah, so actually, all these C values are 0 or 1, and all the S values are bits anyway. We had that already. So we're taking a linear combination of some of the SI. Not all. When CI is zero, I don't include it. So that's what we had. The output of the F function, that's the new bit, Sn. And Sn is then that combination. And I can generalize it a bit. I can say, okay, the next bit, Sn plus 1, I can express that in S1 up to Sn. And as n plus 2, I can describe that into S2 up to Sn plus 1, etc., etc. I can also take the Sn into the equation, but just saying that Cn is equal to 1. What does it mean, Ci? Well, actually, Ci is some kind of selector. If Ci is 1, then that gate is closed, and if Ci is 0, then that gate is open. So it's just selecting a number of these bits, XORing them together, and feeding the result back into the end. So here we have a small example. Length of 4, LFSR of length 4. The first two bits are used in the feedback, and the other two not. So C0 and C1 equals 1, and C2 and C3 equals 0. And the initial state is 1000. So not the all zero state, because I know that then nothing happens. So I'll take something else. Then if I do the first step, I'll forget about the output. I'll just look at the content of the LFSR. The first step, these last three bits, 000, they are pushed to the left. And I XOR the first two bits, a 1 and a 0, which is a 1, and I'll add that to the end. Then the next step, 001 from the end is shifted one position to the left. I XOR the two zeros at the beginning, which is 0, and so 0 appears at the end of that line where it says step 2, etc., etc. And then I can repeat this over and over again, and then at some point you see at step 15, the content is again 1000. That's the content I started with. That's my initial state. And so actually step 16 will then be the same as step 1. And step 17 the same as step 2. It just repeats over and over again. If you want to know what the output bits are, well, it's always the first bit that was pushed out. So the output is 1000, 10011, etc., etc. So I'll just read the column under as 0. That's the output bits. And if I write that out, it should at least look random. Obviously, it's a very short one. So what do we have? The initial state, if I would have started with all zeros, we already know that we don't get anywhere. We keep in that state. On the other end, if I start with anything else, I'll just circle through all the possible states, all the 15 possible states. Yeah, and that's why we call the period of this LFSR, you say that is 15. That's the maximum. I can't get more. That is 16 different states, the all zero state and 15 non-all zero states. Yeah, so I can't do any better than that. Actually, that's the definition of a pseudo-noise sequence. Pseudo-noise sequence is the output of an LFSR of maximal length. So the LFSR has a length n, and the period of the LFSR is 2 to the power n minus 1. There are 2 to the power n possible strings of length n bits. One of them is all 0. I have to remove that one. And the remaining ones are all generated whenever I start with a random filling. Here we have the same LFSR again. Might be a bit more difficult to compare. Here's the old one again. Now I just turned it around, so the output now is all of a sudden again on the right-hand side. The reason for that is because I steal these from the internet, so yeah, I have to take what I get. The output is on the right-hand side now instead of on the left-hand side, but the first two bits, the soon-to-be output bit and the one before, those are fed back into the end. We have that here too. These two last boxes, the output of that is XORed and sent back to the, in this case, left-hand side. Yeah, so these are the same LFSRs. We want to calculate what is called a generator polynomial for this LFSR. So how do we do that, and what is that? If I look to the lines going into these boxes or out of the left the right mouse box, I can see if there is a feedback or not. Yeah, the first box, the first value will always be 1. And then from that first box, there is no output. No feedback, sorry. And so that will be a 0. From the second box, there is no feedback. So a 0 again. From the third box, there will be a feedback. So I select 1. And from the last one, there is also feedback. I select 1 again. So I get a polynomial x to the power 4 plus x plus 1 in this case. And that's the generator polynomial for this linear feedback shift register in this particular case. Yeah, so if I present you, I did not draw it. This is the LFSR we had before. The output was there, and then let's see this one, I believe, and this one fed back. So actually, I get x to the power 8, which is always there. One more, the power is one more than the length of the LFSR. Is exactly the length of the LFSR, sorry. X to the power 7. Then this one is fed back. I start counting here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This one is fed back, so x to the power 6 plus x to the power 2 plus x to the power 1, which is 1. X to the power 0, which is 1. So the generator polynomial for this particular LFSR is x to the power 7 plus x to the power 6 plus x squared plus 1. You can easily calculate that. If that is a polynomial that can be reduced, so I can split it into smaller polynomials, lower degree polynomials, then, in fact, the output of the LFSR will depend on the input state. The period of the LFSR will depend on the input state. The all zero state will, of course, always go back to the all zero state, so I'll forget about that. But if I start with a 0110, actually in 3 steps I'm back. If I would start with 0001, it takes me 6 steps to go back to the original state. And so now, all of a sudden, the length of the output sequence, so the period of the LFSR depends on the starting position. If, however, we started with an irreducible polynomial, so I can't make it smaller, I can't split it into smaller polynomials, smaller degree polynomials, then all these output sequences will have the same length, except, again, the all zero set. I will not repeat that anymore. So here, all of them have length 5. So after 5 steps, I'm back in the original setting. If it is a primitive polynomial, and I'm actually in the exact state where I want to be, now I just have one long sequence that generates all the particular states. Here we have it. If it's a primitive generator polynomial, you will see that I can start with any state, and I'll cycle through all the states and get back to the original again. So now we are generating a pseudo-noise sequence. And these are the output sequences that we can use for crypto. Let's talk a bit about random. What is random? Random means you can't predict what's coming, right? Is the output of an LFSR random? No, I can predict what's coming. If I know the exact state, I know exactly what's going to happen. But it might look random, at least. Let's have a definition of a run of length k. We have a binary bit stream, a run of zeros is a number of consecutive zeros preceded by a 1 and followed by a 1. And a run of zeros is a number of consecutive zeros, but there is a 1 in front and a 1 to the end. We call the zeros, we call a gap, a run of zeros. A run of ones we call a block. So let's see here. Here I have a block of length 3. I don't see any. We have a gap of length 1. Yeah. This is not a block of length 2, because there is a 1 in front and not a 0. Yeah, so it's the maximal length that we can find. For example, here we have two gaps of length 3 in red and one block of length 4 in green. Using these definitions, these runs of zeros and ones, I can define what is called the autocorrelation of a sequence. I have a sequence of n bits, and what I'll do is I'll cyclically shift that sequence over k positions, and then I'll start checking how often do these two values agree and how often do they disagree. So if I have a sequence here, let's erase something. I have a sequence of length 7 here, and I cyclically shifted 3 positions. So I'll 1, 1, 0, 1. And I'll count how often do these two sequences agree and how often do they disagree. So they agree, disagree, disagree, and then they agree a number of times. So the number of agreements is 5 and the number of disagreements is 2. And in this case, the autocorrelation, AC, that is actually the number of agreements, 5, minus the number of disagreements, 2, divided by the length 7, 3 over 7. Simple definition, I guess. Yeah, and I can calculate that for any length of cyclic shift. I now did it for 3 positions, but you can test that for any positions. So here we have another example. We have a bit longer sequence, and we shifted cyclically 4 positions. And actually, I shifted now to the left and not to the right. Yeah, and I get 6 agreements and 10 disagreements. And so in this case, the autocorrelation equals 6 minus 10 divided by the length of the sequence, which was 16. So minus 4 divided by 16, or minus 1/4, minus 0.25. If I don't shift, I shift that thing cyclically 0 positions. I'll keep the string itself, then obviously the autocorrelation is 1. Why? Because all these values agree. So A is actually the length of the length n, and there are no disagreements. So D is 0. So I get n minus 0 divided by n, which is equal to 1. And the autocorrelation in general is a number between 0 and between minus 1 and 1. Suppose I have the alternating sequence 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, and I shifted one position. Yeah, you see that all of the values disagree. So the A is 0 and D is n. And so I get 0 minus n divided by n is minus 1. There are smart people who said something about randomness. Let's give all of them. One of the things that we obviously want to see, if we assume that something is random, is that the number of zeros and the number of ones that I'm seeing is small. Yeah, and if I have a long sequence, it should be equal to 1. At most, 1 difference. Yeah? If I have an output of an LFSR, primitive LFSR, the output length was 2 to the power n minus 1, which is an odd number. And actually, the number of 1s will be 1 more than the number of zeros. So that fits then. In each period, so in each output of the LFSR, I should look at the runs, so the gaps and the blocks, And half of these should have length 1. A quarter of them should have length 2, etc. Obviously, the longer a run becomes, a block or a gap, the less it should appear in this sequence. And the number of gaps and blocks should be equal for a given length. And the third postulate from Goulon was that the autocorrelation should be constant, except for when k is 0, when I'm not doing anything, but that's not an interesting situation anyway. Yeah, so if these three are satisfied, then we say that we have good random sequence. Suppose that I'm generating random numbers, and I have seen this. I've generated 7 zeros in a row. What is more likely for the next bit, 0 or 1? What's more likely for the next bit, 0 or 1? Just guess 1. What would you, if you had to generate the next bit, what would it be? 0? What would it be, the next bit? 1? What would the next bit be? You. Yeah, don't look at me, because if you look at me, I'll ask you something. No, actually, it doesn't matter. It's a 50% chance that it is a 0 and a 50% chance that it is a 1. Because a random bit doesn't know anything what happened before or anything what will happen after. Yeah, so we as humans, if we are generating that, we are getting scared, right? Yeah, we have a dice and we roll the dice and we rolled 6 times a 6 already. And then we roll again 7 times. No, that can't be right. And you take it again. And no, random is random. These things happen. So a pseudo-noise sequence, the one that is generated by a primitive polynomial, is actually something that satisfies all these three postulates. And so by default, it has the same properties as a true random sequence, except the fact that a true random sequence I can generate here, but you can't generate the same one, and these we can generate at different locations. Yeah, if we have the same LFSR, and if we agree somehow on the initial setting, we can generate the same key stream. Yeah, there's an interpretation of that. Flipping a fair coin will give heads and tails equally often. After a run of n heads or tails, still there is a 50-50% chance of what will happen next. I can't say, oh no, I've seen so many zeros now. Now what will be a one? You don't know. And the third one is more or less the same. Not that important. If the output of an LFSR is known, can I then break the system? Well, there is an algorithm for that, Burlick and Massey, that can actually calculate the LFSR within. You don't know the LFSR. That's the assumption. You just see the output sequence. Can I generate then what LFSR it was, and then based on that, know what the next output bits will be? That's the task here. And that's what Burlingham and Massey found out, that was possible. And the task was actually quadratic in the complexity was quadratic in the length of the shortest LFSR generating that particular sequence. There could be more LFSRs. But that's quite some mathematics, and we'll skip that here. For those that will take the crypto course by Slobodan the next semester, that will be dealt with there. If I take a short LFSR, then obviously at some point I see repetition of the key stream, and then it's very easy for me to just determine what will be next. So we have to have some kind of complexity in there. So we have to have as high complexity as possible so that our pseudo-noise sequence gets as long as possible before it starts repeating itself. Remember from last week the Van Ham cipher? It's actually the same, except that I'm now doing it at bit level. Once the security from the Vernon cipher was actually based on the fact that I don't reuse the key. If I use the key letter before once, I throw it away and I don't use it again. Once I start repeating, like in Visionaire, I start repeating the same key bits or key letters, yeah, then the security was down the drain. So here we want something that generates very long pseudo noise sequences that hopefully don't repeat within a particular message. So a few things that we can do is use nonlinear filters or use a nonlinear combiner. Let's see what that is. Here we have an LFSR again, except all of a sudden, in this case, the leftmost bit is not pushed out as output bit. Actually, the output is based on all the bits. There's a combination of those in that function f, and that will be a function that takes as input n bits if the length is n and outputs one bit. That doesn't have anything to do with the LFSR itself. Yeah, so the feedback is still in LFSR, but the output bit is only determined in a different way than it was before. So here is one function. If the length of the LFSR would be 3, which is too short, yeah, I can just multiply the first two bits and then XOR the third bit with it. And then that's my output. And then if you do that, depending on the values of the three bits, I'll get a particular output bit. Yeah, so if all three are 0, the output bit will be 0. If it is 0, 1, 1, well, I multiply 0 and 1, that's 0. And I XOR a 1, okay, the result is 1. Yeah, and look at the output of the f function. 4 zeros, 4 ones, that's perfect, right? First postulate. There should be not a huge difference between the number of zeros and the number of ones. So that's great. Yeah. So now we have a way of getting new output bit, which is not just dependent on the leftmost bit in this case. I'm actually missing a slide. One sec. Missing a slide. I'm talking for 3 quarters already now. We'll soon have a break. Then there is a way of combining multiple LFSRs, so not just one LFSR and combining the bits within that LFSR to a new output. But I have multiple LFSRs, and I just look at the normal output bit, and those bits are then combined. So here I've drawn 3, but there can be more. So as an example, here I have 3 LFSRs, each of them giving me an output bit, and the first two output bits are multiplied together. And so the output of that multiplier will be x1 times x2. The output bits are x1, x2, and x3. The output of the second multiplier, second LFSR, R2, yeah, I'll add 1 to that, so I'll get 1 plus 1 XOR X2 there. And then I'll multiply that with the output of the third LFSR. And so I get 1 XOR X2 times X3. And then those two are, again, combined. So the output in the very end is, you can do the calculation yourself, X2 times the XOR of X1 and X3, XOR X3. That sounds pretty complicated, right? Yeah? Exercise, check this. So here we have, depending on the output bits again, we get a particular output value. The input bits, the output bits from the LFSR, we get a particular output value of the f function. And again, very nicely, there are 4 zeros and 4 ones. Perfect again. Oh, then it says correlation. Now let's check something with correlation. let me see. If the what is the probability that the f function gives the same output as the second LFSR? What is the probability that f equals x2? So if x, I'll start from the top. X2 is 0, f is 0. Okay, that's correct. Then it's 0, 1. Okay, those don't match. And it's 1, 0, they don't match. 1, 0, they don't match. 0, 0, they match again. 0, 1, they don't match. And then twice, that they match. So 4 out of 8 in total. The probability is half. So looking at the f function, the output of the f function, I can't predict what actually the value of x2 was. Could be the same, could be something else. 50% chance. I have to gamble. What if I do the same with f and x1? What value would I get then? What is the probability that the output bit f is the same as the bit x1? Yeah? Sorry? 0.5? No? Let me see. The top one, they are the same. Then they are different. They're the same again, different. Same, same, same. Actually, 6 out of 8. Right? I'll check that first column, and I'll check if it's the same as the last column. And in 6 out of 8 cases, they are the same. Actually, if I do the same for the last one, again, in 6 out of 8 cases, the output bit F is the same as the value of X3. And that's not good. Those two are not good. Because I can't, given the output bits, F, I can't say anything about X2. But I can make predictions. I can make good predictions about what the value of X1 or X3 was. And so that is not something that we want. So this idea of combining them is good, but not in this particular case. Then we have something which is called an irregular clocking LFSR. And there are a few forms of that. There will be a second LFSR that actually determines if an LFSR should step, or in the other form, if the output of the LFSR, if it steps, the original one, will be used. So first we have the bitrate multiplier. That's the case where the second LFSR determines if the bit from the first LFSR, Xn, is used. So Yn determines if Xn is used. There's an example. Y1 is 0, so I use that first bit from X. And then the next value of Y is 1. Okay, I'll skip that one. Yeah, but it's Xn steps, so it will then not output that 1. That value is skipped, but it will output at the second stage, it will output a 0. Then Y is 0 again, and so X will output a 1. Y is 0 again, X will output a 0. Then next, X wants to output a 1 again, but I see that Y is equal to 1. Okay, so that one is skipped, and I'll take the next one. So this one is skipped again, and I'll take the next one again. And I'll get that as output. Having that output, having the original output, I could use Burlakov-Massey if I have enough data to find the generated polynomial for Xn back. And now that values are missing, and I don't know which values are missing, I can't do that. Last slide before the break is the alleged A51 algorithm that is used in GSM. I always call it the alleged A51 algorithm because A51, the encryption algorithm, has never been published. It has been reverse engineered, and people come up with this algorithm, which most likely is the algorithm, but it has never been officially confirmed. In A51. They're using three LFSRs, one of length 19, then 22, and then 23. And you see the feedback. And then you see three of these bits, they are colored. And this is really irregular stepping, because if all three bits are the same, both all three are zero or all three are one, all three LFSRs will make one step. If there are two that are, let's say the top two ones are zero, that yellow bit, and the third one is one, then only the top two ones make a step, and the bottom one will not step. It will just stay in its current state. The other two make a step, and that one not. Yeah? So that's how A51 is apparently working. A51 has been broken. I'll go into that. There are different algorithms in GSM now, A52, A50. If you have a mobile phone that's using A50, then you're not using encryption. A50 is plain text. Any questions so far about stream ciphers, about LFSRs? In Blackboard, I wrote that you had to read also chapter 20 for today, plus some parts of chapter 2. Amongst others, RC4, which is a stream cipher, is discussed in the book. So I will not have it in class, but you can read all about it. Okay, let's have, if there are no questions, then let's have a break. It's now on my watch, it is 10 past. Let's come back together in 15 minutes. Yeah, still many slides. Okay, good. Okay. Shall we continue then? Bring up that one again. If you want to know more about the A51 algorithm, there is a link where you can see some animation. That's always interesting. One of the ideas I had for the first assignment was asking people to make an implementation of A51. Maybe the current assignment was nicer to do. Let's leave the stream ciphers for what they are, and let's continue with the block ciphers. So the difference between the stream cipher and the block cipher is that a stream cipher generates a key bit whenever it's needed and is encrypting the plain text one bit at a time. A block cipher will look at a block of plain text bits, will encrypt that, that at once, and then will go on to the next block. So in a more formal definition, we have a block of size n and a key of size k, all in bits. And then those two are combined in the encryption algorithm, and out comes a ciphertext of n bits. So the length of the ciphertext at least is equal to the length of the plain text block. And the key is in general shorter. Can be longer also, depends on depends on the algorithm. We'll first start with so-called Faisal structures, and then we'll go over to substitution permutation networks. Faisal structures is a structure that was first invented by Horst Faisal, who worked for IBM at the time, I think in mid-70s approximately. And the idea is here in this picture. We have a plain text block, and we divide that in two parts, and then we'll do operations on the separate parts. And then the output is this is what is called a round, and then the output is again into the input to the next round, etc., etc. So what we do is we have a plain text block of two n bits, and we divide it into a left n bits half and a right n bits half. And then the right n bits half. Oh, first the right half. Is first fed into this function f, what is mentioned there, and there is also a key coming in there, and then the output of that f function, that is XORed with the left block, and then that result is actually put on the right hand side, and the right block by itself is copied without any changes, is copied to the left side. That should be n bits, of course, not 2n bits. Yeah, so there is an operation on the right block on the top there, and then it's combined with the left block. Yeah, and then the blocks are swapped. That's the whole Faisal structure. And then we repeat that a number of times, and then we have the full encryption algorithm. As said, the round function, the f function, in that box in the middle, has two inputs, the right block bits and the sub key. And the sub key is something that is derived from the master key. So the master key is the general key that we share, and then there is a key scheduling algorithm that will derive a number of sub keys from that master key, and those will be used in each of these rounds. So mathematically, the I plus first left half is the previous right half, and the new right half is the previous left half plus the output of the f function, the round function. There is a lot of variation possible if you look at a Faisal structure. The most variation can obviously be done in that f function. How does that manipulate the bits from the right block plus the key bits? Number of rounds can be varying. Number of bits in each of these blocks, or the number of bits of the block length in general, can be a variation. How are the subkeys derived from the master key? And sometimes there is—it's not necessary—but sometimes there is an initial or a final operation on the bits. So before the bits go into the first round, there is some operation on them, or after they come out of the last round, there is an operation on them. Obviously, if I encrypt something, I want the other side to decrypt, to be able to decrypt. Well, if I look at that picture again, encryption was going down. Yeah, so we have a left block. Sorry, we have a right block which is copied to the left, and we have the left block which is combined with the output of the F function, and that's going to the right. Can I go back? Can I get from these two? Let me see. Yep. Can I get from these two blocks back to these two blocks? Well, this one is easy. I just look at what's here, and that I put there. What's here? Well, I have to undo this XOR operation. Can I do that? Well, I can, because actually I know the value of this block, which is just this value. And so I can copy that back and then input it into the F function. Yeah, and then XOR the result with this one, and then I get the original left block again. So yeah, I can do decryption also, which is good. So you see that now the algorithm is slightly different. Instead of going down and around, I'm going up. But basically, it's the same algorithm. I get some questions about the assignment too. I get questions, do you want, because I want the key for the encryption. As they ask me, do you want the key for the encryption or the decryption? It's essentially the same key. Slightly represented in a different way, but essentially it's the same key. In this case, I don't really care which one. But anyway, this is a FISOL structure. When I do encryption, I can do decryption afterwards, so all of that is good. Some examples, DES is the best known, maybe AES nowadays. DES stands for Data Encryption Standard. Uses 64-bit blocks, so two halves of 32 bits, 16 rounds and a 56-bit key, which is too short nowadays. There are some other ones. Actually, AES is not there because it's not a FISOL structure. But these are the 3DES is actually a combination of DES applied three times. I'll get back to that. Some more about DES, because that's where all these FISOL structures started. DES the FISOL structure was originally designed by Horst Feistel, and that was submitted by IBM to NSA to become the new encryption standard. So there was a request from NSA to come up with encryption algorithms such that that could be a new standard that everybody could use. So Horst Feistel from IBM came with an algorithm, and then NSA adjusted it such that it became even more secure, and that was then the new data encryption standard. It was published in 1977, so it's quite old already. It's almost 40 years old next year. The key is 8 bytes long, 64 bits. But actually, from every byte, one bit is used as parity bit. So it's not used in the key scheduling, but yeah, it's just a meaningless bit. So the actual size of the key is 56 bits, 8 bits less. As said, it was modified by the NSA. I'll talk about that when I come to the DES boxes. NSA really made it more secure. I'll tell that in a minute. In a brief overview, as said before, there are 16 rounds, 16 of these FISOL structures. There is an initial permutation and there is a final permutation. Actually, the final permutation is the inverse of the initial permutation. Yeah, but it doesn't really add anything to the security. Yeah, I'll just permute the bits. It's a bit permutation. So it doesn't do anything for security. This is the initial permutation, and you should read it as the 58th input bit, that will be the first output bit. And the 50th input bit will be the second output bit, and the 42nd input bit will be the third output bit, etc., etc. So simple permutation, very structured. Doesn't really add to security, but for some reason they put it in there. As said, in a Faisal structure, in a Faisal cipher, you have this round function. And in case of this, that looks like this. We have the write block, 32 bits. Remember, the block length is 64, so half of that. That is expanded to 48 bits. In a very simple way, again, I'll show that in a minute. The subkey is then XOR to that expanded write block. And then we get 48 bits out of that, and that is fed into eight. That is split into eight groups of 6 bits. 6 times 8 is 48. Each of these 6 bits are fed into an S box, and the S box turns them into 4 bits again. And then all of these now 8 times 4 bits, 32 bits, are permuted again, and that's the output. It's again a bit permutation there. So first the expansion. Just copying bits. So what we'll do is we'll split the input up in 8 blocks of 4 bits, and then each block gets the first bit of the next block added to it, and the last bit of the previous block added to it, and then I have 6 bits. And then I'll put all these groups of 6 bits together again, and that's it. Then let's look at, well, the XOR of a key is relatively simple. We know how that happens. We don't know what the subkey is yet. We'll get to that. But we have a subkey. We have the output of the extension, which is 48 bits, and we can just combine them. But then we have to put them into an S-box. So we split it up in 8 groups of 6 bits, as I said, and each of these 6 bits is going into its own S-box. There are 8 different S-boxes. And then the output of each S-box is a 4-bit value. All the S-boxes are different. Here is the first S-box. It's a simple table. 4 rows, 16 columns. No more, no less. So how do we turn 6 bits into 4 output bits using this? Well, note first that each row is actually a permutation of the numbers 0 to 15. Well, you can check that if there are no doubles. But 0 to 15 is actually all the binary values 0, 0, 0, 0, up to 1, 1, 1, 1. So actually, in each of these rows, in binary, I see a permutation of a four-digit number. Yeah, all the four-digit numbers, four-bit numbers are in there. Yeah. No. Yeah. Sure. True. Other S-boxes, not these. AES, we'll get to AES later. But AES is a substitution permutation network, another Faisal structure. But many of block ciphers use S-boxes. Yeah? S stands for substitution. So it's just substituting 6 bits with 4 bits in a fixed manner. Yeah? If I have the same input, 6 input bits to S-box 1, I'll get the same output bits again, over and over again. Yeah, so every row is actually a permutation of a 4-bit value. And let's see how we get to the value that we want. So 6 input bits, I1 up to X, I6. And what I'll do is I'll use the 2 outer bits, I1 and I6, and I split those from the 4 input bits, for the inner bits, sorry, I2, 3, 4, and 5. And actually the 2 outer bits, it's a 2-bit value, so it's 0, 1, 2, or 3. And the inner bits is a 4-bit value, so something between 0 and 15. And if you look in the S-box, in S-box 1, you see that actually the rows are numbered 0 to 3 and the columns are numbered 0 to 15. So not 1 to 4 and 1 to 16, but we start at 0. So actually that 2-bit value is pointing to a row, and that 4-bit value is pointing to a column. And that's the only thing that it does. The output will now be what is represented in that particular row and that particular column that these bits are pointing to. As an example, what would be the value now? What would be the row number that it is pointing at? Look at the outer bits, 0, 0. Row 0. The inner bits is 1, 0, 0, 1. That's row 9. Sorry, column 9. So row 0, column 9, and I look at row 0, column 9, and I see a value there. Yeah? I see the value 2, so that's the output. So S1 operating on 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0 will output 0, 0, 1, 0, value 2. Is that clear? You can do that? Yeah? Okay. Go ahead. I can drink coffee at the same time. Start with the first four. Yeah, the last one, actually the last two are slightly connected. First four are just applying what I just did. First five, actually, are just applying what I just did. Thanks. So let's see the first one. Who has the answer? So 101010. What row does that represent? 2. Good. What column does this represent? 5. Row 2, column 5. Yeah, 11. Or in binary. Right? Yeah. How about the next one? What's the answer to this one? Let's go straight away. 2? Okay. What's the next one? 8, exactly. Note here that I only changed one input bit, but that two output bits are different. That's one of the design criteria of an S-box. Changing one input bit will change at least two output bits. I'll give the other ones. Note here, the output was 1110. Well, actually, this part and this part is the same. And that it happens a couple of more times. There. Here are all the S boxes, 8 different S boxes. This is notably where NSA made some changes in these S-boxes. Not the structure. 624 and everything was there. But they changed. You can just randomly generate a permutation of the number 0 to 15 and then do that 4 times and you have one S-box, right? Yeah, that will probably not be a good S-box. So there are some underlying properties of an S-box. I will not discuss them here. That make them a good S-box or a bad S-box. And actually in 1977, NSA was aware of these. An attack on S-boxes was developed somewhere in the second half of the 90s, I believe it was, where they actually then discovered that the way that these S-boxes were designed meant that the attack wasn't really successful. So in 1977, NSA knew that attack already because they designed their S-boxes to be resistant against that attack. So they pretty much have good knowledge of crypto. Can't say anything else. But they have more cryptographers employed than any other organization. One more thing about the F function, the round function, is that there was this bit permutation at the end. And again, there is a fixed permutation. This has some value on the security, of course, because the structure of where the bits start and where they end up is mixed up again. I mentioned the final permutation already. That was the inverse of the initial permutation, so that's not that interesting. And here we have the full DES. There's one slight difference. Know that after each round, the left and right half are swapped, right? The right half is going to the left half, and the result of the F-box in the left half is going to the right. That doesn't happen after the last round. Again, without going into details, that is to make sure that I can use the same algorithm. Suppose that it is implemented in hardware. I can use the same algorithm with different key scheduling to do the decryption, purely for that. Let me see. I mentioned that. The key scheduling. The key was a 56-bit key, and every subkey was 48 bits. So how do we derive that from the master key, the 56-bit key? Well, there is a key schedule here. Looks quite. Let me see. Bits in the first key are first permuted. Again, a permutation of the keys. And then split, similar structure as for a FISL cipher, but they're treated slightly different. And so, we'll not go into too much detail. But anyway, from the 56 original keys, 48-bit subkeys are derived, and all bits of the original key are used in deriving all these subkeys. Yeah, and they're mixed and matched and whatever. Yeah, we'll forget about this. Only just to show here that in the top drawing, every eighth bit is ignored. So you can set that to zero. There were some, let's say, not so smart implementations of this, where actually the first bit was ignored. Yeah, and this, they thought they were using the eighth and the sixteenth bit, etc., etc. And so all of a sudden they reduced their key space by again 8 bits, because all the first bits in that column were set to zero. Yeah, that's encryption. I mentioned that. That's the full picture again. The decryption, I think I already said that, so that we can go backward. Yeah, also here in the last round when we didn't do the swap, but that doesn't really add any significance. So indeed, given L16 and R16, I can find L15 and R15. And if I can do that once, I can repeat it all the way back to L0 and R0. And the permutations are just fixed permutations, easy to undo. The reason that the final and the initial and the final permutation are each other's inverses is again linked to the fact that I want to do this, use the same algorithm with a different key schedule for the decryption. And the different key schedule means that instead of using K1, K2 up to K16, I'm using K16, K15 down to K1. That's the only thing. Oh, we talked about that. Yep. DES has a 56-bit key. If you're smart in programming and have good hardware, maybe a couple of machines that you can dedicate to that, you can break that. That's not extremely difficult. It's not trivial, by the way. It's not like press the button and there it is. Yeah, but you can do that. People can do that. NSA can do that easily. There are two alternatives to DES. One is two-key DES. Let's look at that first. That's actually not an alternative, but I want to say mention it anyway. I apply DES twice. So I have a plain text, and I use a key to encrypt that, and then I use another key to encrypt that again. So actually, if I want to break it, I need the first key, 56 bits, and the second key, 56 bits. Yeah, and then I can break it. Right? So I actually have a key that is twice as long, K1 and K2 together, or 112 bits. Yeah, there where 56-bit is doable, this is not twice as long, 112 bits, this is 2 to the power of 56 times as long. So if I could do it, suppose that I could do it in 1 second, now I need 2 to the power of 56 seconds. I don't know how many that are, but that's a couple of years. So that's good, right? Actually, it's not that good. Actually, the effective security of this system is only 57 bits. I only get 1 bit security. How is that? How do I break this system? Well, it's what's called a meet in the middle attack. Suppose that I get access to a pair plain text ciphertext. Now that's an assumption that I make. I know the plain text that you sent me, that you sent to somebody, and I see the ciphertext. Somehow I got access to the plain text also. So actually I know M and I know C. Well, I can just try all the 2 to the power of 56 different keys, K2, and I can calculate X from that. Yeah, the encryption of the message, the plain text. But I have the ciphertext also. And again, I try all 2 to the power of 56 different keys on decrypting that ciphertext, and I'll get a value Y. 2 to the power of 56 different values Y. And 2 to the power of 56 different values X, of course. Yeah, for each key that I try, each key K1, I'll get a Y, and for each key K2, I'll get an X. If I would have selected K1 and K2 correctly, then I know that x equals y. Can we see that? Well, if I choose the correct one, then the decryption of C is actually the decryption of that twice encrypted, so that first encryption, that outer encryption is removed, and so y is equal to the encryption of k2 by m, oh, which is the same as x, if I selected the correct ones. Yeah, so I just made that big table. This key gives me, this K1 gives me this Y, this K1 gives me this Y, etc., etc. And I made a similar table for all the X's. And then I'll start checking where in those two tables I get the same value, X equals Y. The first is 2 to the power 56 operations work. The second also, together, 2 to the power 56 plus 2 to the power 56 is 2 to the power 57. Okay, so 2 deaths is not a good system. Doesn't really add to security. 1 bit isn't really adding. So what about 3 deaths? We'll just go further and further. In 3 deaths, we do the following. We encrypt, we decrypt, and we encrypt again. So I take a message. I encrypt it with a key, I decrypt it with another key, and I encrypt it again with a key. And I'm using 3 keys. So the effective key length will be 168 bits. And now the meet-in-the-middle attack is no longer possible. Yeah, I can do something, but then still I can have the decryption of C, and then I have a long list of that, 2 to the power 56. But then for the other part, I have the encryption of M and the decryption of that result again. There I still have to do 112 bits work. So the security now is, again, 112 bits. What is the big advantage of triple DES? Well, actually, it is compatible with normal DES. So if you have installed normal DES and I have triple DES, I'll just pick my K2 and K3 the same. I have a message. I encrypt it and then I decrypt it. I'm back at my message again. And then the K1, that's the one that we share. That's the one that you use and I use. That's there. Okay. We talked about stream ciphers first, and I could generate an endless stream of bits. Yeah, if my LFSR or my feedback shift register was large enough, I will generate plenty of different bits before I start cycling again. In a block cipher, in DES, for example, I can encrypt 64 bits at a time. Right? What do I do when I have 128 bits? How do I handle that? Well, what I can do then is just split these 128 bits into twice 64 bits. And then somehow I have to combine that. That's what we call a mode of operation. So I look at my plain text, and I know the block length of my cipher, my encryption algorithm, 128 or 64 or whatever, and then I'll start splitting up my plain text in these size blocks. So 8 bytes or 16 bytes at a time. And then I can encrypt each block by itself. Right? I have a key. I'll just encrypt each of these blocks. Well, maybe it's smarter to do it in a different way. The method that I just mentioned is called electronic codebook. I'll get to that in a minute. But we want some link between various blocks for different reasons, for security reasons at the very least. Let's go into these modes. Then I guess it all becomes clear. Electronic codebook is very simple way. Okay, I have 128 bits, encrypted. I have the next 128 bits, encrypted, etc., etc. Decryption is easy, right? I have a cipher. I have this first 128-bit cipher. I decrypt it. Second, I decrypt it, etc., etc. I can encrypt and I can decrypt. But this, if I as an attacker would all of a sudden swap a number of blocks or remove some blocks, you couldn't see that. So there's no link between any of these blocks. If there is some structure, actually I could use that to attack this system. So although very easy, it's not very secure. This is CBC, cipher block chaining. Okay, now I'm making a link between the various blocks. So the first block, I encrypt. Well, I add some initial value to that. I XOR it with some initial value. And then I encrypt it. And the next block, I'll add some value too, but I'm not taking an initial value there. Actually, I'll take the output of the first encryption. And I'll add that to the second block. And then I go on and on. So can I decrypt that? Well, if I have C1, I can decrypt it. I don't have the plaintext yet, but I can XOR the initial value again. Initial value, there's you can't keep it secure, you can't keep it secret, but it's actually not needed. Security of a crypto algorithm should be in the key, not in anything else. Yeah, so from C1, I can find P1 back. Well, then look at C2. I can decrypt it, and then I don't have P2 yet, but I have C1. Okay, from that decryption, I'll XOR that with C1, with the previous plaintext block, ciphertext block, and I get my P2 back, etc., etc. Yeah, and now, all of a sudden, if somebody changes a block or changes the order of the block, decryption will go wrong, and I'm able to detect that. If somebody takes away a block, around where that block was taken away, things will go wrong. That's the decryption, and the decryption also in mathematics. Cipher feedback. I'm using a shift register again. That has some initial value. And the output of that shift register, I'll wait until I have enough bits for the block length, and then I encrypt that. And then actually I'll use a number of bits from that encryption to do encryption with the block cipher, and I'll XOR those bits to the plaintext block to get the first ciphertext block. So actually the encryption of the plaintext is a simple XOR from the output of the encryption algorithm. So the encryption algorithm by itself does not work on the plaintext or the ciphertext bits. Yeah, know that. And then the result of that is then again added to the shift register, inputted to the shift register, and then the process starts again. Most will be do this byte by byte, but you can do it bit by bit, or you can use everything or whatever. Decryption, it's the same again. I'll start with the same filling of the shift register. I do the encryption of that content, so that as input. And then, yeah, if C1 was P1 XOR those selected bits, yeah, I can easily go back. Yeah, but I can then use the ciphertext, which I have anyway, and I'll put that in the shift register again, etc., etc. Output feedback. Again, I will not be encrypting the message itself, the plaintext itself, but again, I will start with some kind of initial vector, and I encrypt that, and I use that result to XOR with the plaintext to get the ciphertext. But I use it again. So the output of the encryption algorithm, I'll encrypt again. I use it again for an XOR. And then I'll encrypt it again. So I have one initial value that I start with, and I keep encrypting that over and over again. Yeah, and the result is every time XOR to the plaintext. Well, then, obviously, that was too fast. There. Obviously, decryption is exactly the same as encryption. Yeah, except that I add the ciphertext to the output of the encryption of the IV, or the re-encryption of the IV, or whatever. Then the last mode, I think, that I have is the counter mode. Again, the encryption algorithm, the block cipher, I should say, is not working on the plain text or on the ciphertext itself. It's working on now a counter. And there, why I re-encrypted something before, I now just change the counter. I need to have a different input. A one-bit input to a block cipher will result in general in half of the bits changing in the output. Yeah. And so I start with a value, and I'll increase that value every time, and the new value is again encrypted, and XOR to the plaintext. Increase the counter, encrypt it, XOR to the plaintext, etc., etc. And again, decryption is exactly the same. Yeah. So much for the Feistel structures. We'll have a break now. After the break, I will continue with substitution permutation network. I have about 25 slides left. I know it's a lot of input this week, probably also next week. Apologies for that. Try to do it more calmly next week. So instead of 2 hours of teaching and 3 hours of exercises, what we'll do now is a bit more teaching and then a little less time for exercises. So what we'll do now is let's have a bit shorter break. If you come back in, let's say, 10 minutes, and then we'll quickly go over the substitution permutation networks and the key distribution. Any questions so far before we go to the break? Was that clear? So I can ask anything about DES now? On the exam, I mean. Sorry? What is the output of the... No, just kidding. No, I could ask that. I could ask you, here is an S-box. This is the input. What is the output? I could ask that. Yeah? So you have to know how an S-box works. Or I could ask you in general how a Feistel structure looks like. Or I will not ask you what is the initial permutation of DES. You don't need to know these details. If I want to know that, or if I want to know something about an S-box, if you can work on an S-box, I will give you an S-box. I'm not asking you to recite S-box 1. Or two, or whatever. Yeah? So no worries about that. It's more important that you know how stuff works instead of memorizing the details that you can anyway look up everywhere. Yeah? Other questions? And remember, can that be on the exam? Or will that be on the exam, was the question. Yes, it can. Yes, it will. Okay, let's have a... was that a question or not? Okay. Then we'll have a break now. Okay. Let's quickly continue. We discussed the stream ciphers, we discussed the Firestall structure, and now we're going to substitution permutation network. Again, it's an algorithm that works in a number of rounds, and each round will have a nonlinear function, which is often an S-box, and a linear layer, which is often a permutation. I will go quickly to not take that much time. The best known algorithm is AES, Advanced Encryption Standard, and I'll go into detail of that. That's actually not the first substitution permutation network. Actually, IDEA was much older. So IDEA was from the 80s, I believe. I don't know, from Switzerland. About the Advanced Encryption Standard, at some point, NIST realized that DAS was not secure anymore and that there should become a replacement. And then in the end of the 90s, there was a competition for research groups in crypto to come up with new proposals for the algorithm. And there was, I think, 15 that survived the first round. So those were really considered, and there were analysis were done. Were a couple of rounds, two or three rounds, I believe. At some point, there were just five algorithms left, and in the end, it was Randall, an algorithm from Belgium, that was chosen to be the new encryption standard. When NIST came with this request, they had some requirements on the new algorithms. The block length should be fixed, 128 bits. The longer the block length, the more secure an algorithm is. The key length should be variable, should be either 128 bits, 192 or 256 bits. So those were requirements from NIST. The implementation from Randall was such that for the short key, they had 10 rounds, and the longer the key became, they had more rounds. In AES, they now use what they call a state, a 4x4 matrix, and each element in that matrix contains a byte value. So 16 elements times a byte is 8 bits. So 128 bits, so that fits nicely. And every round, 10, 12, or 14 rounds, every round there are actually four operations. A substitute of the bytes in the matrix, in the state, a shift of the row, a mix of the columns, and an add of the round key. In the description that I'll give, I'll focus on 128 bits. The descriptions for 256 or 192 bits are very similar. This, anyway, is the same. There is a round zero, independent of the key length, and in the round zero, we just add the key. That's the actual key. From that, we'll derive also a number of subkeys, but this is the actual key that is XORed here. And then each round, for the first nine rounds, not the last round, but each for the first nine rounds, we have these four stages. We substitute the bytes, we have a shift of the row, a mix of the columns, and the key is added again. And in the last round, in the round number 10, actually the mixed columns is not there. Yeah. So adding a key. Yeah, that's simple. I have a state, 4x4 matrix with each having a byte value in there, and I have a key of length 128, or subkey, doesn't matter, which is again in this 4x4 matrix, and each entry is a byte, and I'll just XOR. Very simple. So 32 XOR 2B is 19 in hexadecimal. I guess you all speak hexadecimal. Yeah, 3, 2, 3, 2, and then that was 2B. B is 11. Yeah, and I XOR that. That's 1, That's 9. Was that correct?
Yeah.
I speak hexadecimal too. And you do that for all these 16 entries. So that's the add key. The add key is very simple. Then the round starts always with a substitution. And we got an S-box again. And this is a different S-box than the ones we had. This is a 16 times 16 table. And what I'll do is I'll look at a byte input. And I look at the first 4 bits. And look at the second 4 bits. And one determines the first one determines the row. The second one determines the column. And so actually 19 will then go to D4. If I would see 19 again, it would be permuted to D4 again. Just one S-box for AES, no more. Used every round. The shift row, also very easy operation. I shift a row, cyclically shift. First row I leave as is. I don't do anything. The second row, apologies for the mouse pointer. The second row, I'll shift one position to the left. So the second byte comes in the first position, the third byte in the second position, etc. And the first byte actually is shifted to the last position. It's a cyclic shift. I'll do the same with the second, with the third row, except I do a double cyclic shift over 2 positions, and the last one is cyclic shift over 3 positions. Or one position to the right, that's the same. Yeah, that's easy to understand. Then we have the mixed column. And that's the difficult operation in AES. Because it uses Galois field multiplication and addition. And don't worry too much about if you don't know what that is, but I'll see if we can get some knowledge anyway. If I see a byte value, I can regard that as a polynomial. So this times, if I have this one, this times x to the power 0, x to the power 1, x to the power 2. So actually this polynomial, this byte, stands for x to the power 5 plus x to the power 4 plus x. So I can regard a byte as a polynomial. So 1, 2, and 3, as in that matrix, that's the multiplication matrix that we're going to use. 1, 2, and 3 simply stand for polynomials either which are 1 or x plus 1. Whenever there is a 3, that means the polynomial x plus 1. Then we're going to look at the first column. And that first column, I'm going to multiply with that matrix. And I have to quickly look at it myself. Yeah, I'll use the first row of this multiplication matrix. 2, 3, 1, 1. And I multiply that by the first column of that yellow matrix. So that's the one we're working on, right? That's the state. So 2 times D4 and 3 times E0 and 1 times B8 and 1 times E1E. Except 1 is not 1. Yeah, 1 is 1. Except 2 is not 2. 2 is X. And D4 is, again, some polynomial. In fact, if I write that out, the polynomial D4 is x to the power 7 plus x to the power 6 plus x to the power 4 plus x squared. Yeah, write out D4 in bits. See which bits are 1, and those correspond to powers of x. Yeah, and so if I have to multiply 2 by D4, so that means the polynomial x, remember 2 stands for x, times the polynomial that is represented by D4, and I'll get actually x to the power 8 plus x to the power 7 plus x to the power 5 plus x to the power 3. And then 3 times BF. Okay, I have to calculate that too. There's a lot of calculation, but in the very end, I do all the calculations, modulo x to the power 8, and I'll get x squared. That's an easy result. And x squared, I'll turn back into a byte value again. So here, x squared. So this is only this one. So we get all zeros except here and then there. Two zeros again. Well, that represents the byte value 0, 4. I can do that if I take the first, you know, matrix multiplication? So I should have asked that first. Do you know matrix multiplication? If I have one matrix, and I multiply it by another matrix, I'll get a matrix again, all 4 by 4 matrices in this case. I multiply the first row by the first column, I'll get this value. I multiply the first row by the second column, I'll get this value. First row, third column, first row, fourth column, I'll get this value. Now I'll take the second row, first column, here, and then I'll keep filling that. That's normal matrix multiplication. You can easily find that. So I'll take the first, I'll take now the first column again, and I multiply by, sorry, what do I do now? Let me see. I multiply the second column here by the first column. Yeah, so first row by first column, I got this one. Second row, first column, I will get this value. Remember the first that we calculated was 0, 4. Now let's see what if we take the second row of the multiplication matrix again and the first column again. So I'm trying to reconstruct the resulting first column. Yeah, I can do all the calculations again, a lot of work. I reduce modulo that reduction polynomial, and I'll get, what do I get? 6, 6. And I repeat it again. Third row, 1, 1, 2, 3, times that first column again, and I get the third value, which is 8, 1. And then I'll do it again, and I'll get E5. Yeah, and then I should repeat it also for the second. Now I just did the first row there. First column there. I should repeat it also for the second column, the third column, and the fourth column. But that's a lot of work. I don't want to do that now. But you see that the first column is now replaced by this. Through this mixed column operation, I get this as the new first column. Remember that D4, BF, etc. Oh, that was the first column there. I'll copy that. I just did the calculation on the first column, and I get a new first column. Remember, this operation is called the mixed column. So I'm mixing just this column. And I'll get this result. 04, 6, 6, 8, 1, and E5. And then I'll do that for the second column and the third column and the fourth column also, and then I'll get that result. Again, the first column is still the same. So that's the difficult operation in, mathematically seen, the difficult operation in AES. This is, however, an operation that can very fast be implemented in hardware. So AES will run extremely fast in hardware. And then the round key addition is a simple XOR again. Yeah, so we had the substitution of the bytes, we had the shift of the rows, we had the mixed column, and then we have the round key. That's one round, and then we go to the next round. Round keys. Oh, we haven't said how those are calculated, right? We just had the XOR of the original key in the beginning. We don't have the round keys yet. Okay, let's see how we can make the round keys. This is the original one, the original key, but there are 10 round keys. And each round key is, again, a set of 4 of these columns. So I need to make 40 more of these columns. So I have 44 columns in total. Remember, I have the round key before I start round 1, and then in each of the 10 rounds. Actually, For each of these blocks of four columns, there is a different operation for the first column, and the next three are the same. Not the same as the first one, but the same as themselves. Yeah. Let's see how we do that. I'll take the last column that I know. So the previous column. If I'm now making column 5, I look at column 4. And I'll do it. I rotate that one byte up. That's easy. Then, you know, the S box from a couple of slides ago, I use it again here. I also use it for the encryption, but I also use it for the key scheduling. And I'll figure out what CF is mapped to, and that's apparently 8A, and 4F is mapped to 8-4, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll take the previous column, I shift it one cyclic one up, and then I'll apply the S-box. And then, in the last step, to get the final result for that fifth column, what I'll do is I'll take the first column, so four columns back, and the result that I just calculated, and something called a round constant, and those three are added up. So the first column, 2B7E, XOR with the result that I just calculated, XOR with this round constant, and that will give me the new column. There it is. So I take four columns back and some operation on one column back plus a round constant, and those three elements are added. For the next three ones, I'll just do it simply. I'll take the previous column and four columns back. So in if I look at where 88 says, it says A0 XOR 2A, 28, and that will be that 88. And so I quickly fill these other three columns. Then the first column of that next block, I'll use the complicated operation again. And then I have three easy operations. And so I'll continue until I fill all these columns. The round constant, that's again using polynomials. Actually, it's just a representation of x to the power I minus 1. Modulo the same polynomial as we use in this mixed column operation. Yeah, so the first time I use x to the power 0, which is 1. The next time I'll use x to the power 1, x, then x squared, x to the power 3, etc., etc. So the first few are very easy. I see one bit shifting towards the left-hand side. At some point, when I am looking at the round constant for the ninth subkey, I get to x to the power 8. I have to do this modulo. So I have to calculate modulo x to the power 8 plus x to the power 4, 3, x, and plus 1. Yeah, so x to the power 8 actually is the same as x to the power 4 plus x to the power 3 plus x plus 1, which, as a byte represented, is 1b. Next time I multiply that with x again, because x to the power 10, x to the power 9 is x times x to the power 8. But I know already what x to the power 8 modulo this polynomial is, so I can multiply that by x. Yeah, so 1b becomes 3/6. Yeah, write it out in binary, 1b. B is 11. And then I'll shift it one position to the right, so this 3/6. And we're just using these values, so you can just remember those. That was AES. Which is easier, AES or DES? Well, the description, I mean, not the algorithm. I think the description of AES is very complicated when it comes to this mixed column, but otherwise it's relatively simple also. Let's say a few final words about the key distribution. Yeah, I took all my keys back, because if you have a key distribution system, at some point you have to destruct the keys also when they're not in use anymore. I'll not do that. The library will not be happy when I do that. Alice wants to talk to Bob. Yeah, that's normal. And then she needs a key, because she wants to do it in a secure way. But what's more, Alice wants to talk to Carol. She needs a key for that. We saw that in the beginning. She needs a different key for that. And if she wants to talk to Dave, she needs a different key. Suppose that we stop now. Alice, Bob, Carol, and Dave. And everybody wants to talk to everybody without the other two knowing about it. So Dave and Bob want to talk without Alice and Carol knowing anything about what they're saying. How many keys do we need here? If we just have these four people. Well, let's see. Any suggestions yet, or should I give the answer? Okay, we wanted that Alice can talk to Bob. That's one key. And Alice wants to talk to Carol. That's a key. And Alice wants to talk to Dave. Then Bob. Bob wants to talk to, he wants to talk to Alice, but he has a key already. Oh, so that's good. Then he needs not another key for that. That's symmetric. It's the same key. But Bob wants to talk to Carol too, and Bob wants to talk to Dave. And finally, Carol and Dave want to talk together. Yeah, Dave wants to talk to Bob, he uses the same key. We don't need another key there. So we need six keys. Okay. That's doable. Four people, we have six keys. That's not a big deal. 19 people in class. How many keys do we need? Sorry, say again. 19 factorial? That will be a bit too much. That will be a bit too much. Will be too much also. We have four users here, and the number of keys is indeed 3 factorial, but that's by accident. So that's not the rule. Every person has to talk to every other person, and for each of these we need a different key, right? So every person wants to talk to so many other persons. And for all of these, we need a key. Well, except, as I said, if there is a key between Alice and Bob, that's the same as the key between Bob and Alice. So actually, I've counted a bit too much. I counted each key twice. Because Alice was there, and then Bob is here. But Bob is here as one of the users also, and then Alice is in this set also. So I counted too much. So 19 times 18 divided by 2. 19 times 9 is 171 keys. I hope. Yeah. If I have 10 users, 45 keys. If I have 60 users, there are about 60 people in class, I have 1,770 keys already. If we want, let's say, all people at IMT talking together, we need 500,000 keys already. It's exploding. If we want everybody at NTNU talking together, we need millions of keys. Yeah, so that's quite a lot. In general, yeah, this is Cn,2. I don't know if you know the notation. That just means n times n minus 1 divided by 2. If n people, I need n times n minus 1 divided by 2 keys. That's a lot. What's more, how do we make sure that everybody gets the correct key? Yeah, if I want to talk to all of you, I'm not going to visit your home, everybody separately, and then giving a key, and then you doing the same. That's a lot of work. There is a possibility that beforehand you distribute the keys. If the army is going on a military operation, they will get a set of keys before they leave. But often it's very cumbersome. Well, we could maybe use something like a key distribution center, because that sounds good, right? It's a distribution. It's a center that takes care of the distribution of the keys. That must be what we need. So how does it work? Alice and Bob again, as always. And Alice and Bob want to use the key distribution center. So what happens? Alice wants to say something to Bob, but she doesn't have a key shared with Bob. She has a key actually shared with the key distribution center, as has everybody. So we all have a key that we share with the KDC. That's the only key that we have now. And so Alice wants to talk to Bob, and she sends a message to the key distribution center saying, "Hey, it's me, Alice. I would like to send a message to Bob that Carol and Dave can't hear about." And then what the key distribution center does is they send back a key to Alice to use in that communication with Bob. So they send back the key that Alice and Bob can use. Not in plain, obviously, because if they send it in plain, yeah, everybody can see that. Eve is looking and she says, "Oh, key, I can use that." Misuse that. Yeah, so, but Alice and the KDC, they share a key already. And so that communication between Alice and the KDC can be secured. That can be encrypted. And so they are encrypting that, so when the key distribution center is sending that key, they will make sure that it is in a secure manner, in a confidential manner. Nobody else can get access. And actually what they do also is they have the same key that Alice and Bob will use, and they encrypt it for Bob also, and then they send it to Bob with the message, "Hey, this is the key that you will have to use when Alice is sending you something." So Alice and Bob get a key that is just generated by the KDC in some random manner, and then the KDC encrypts it for Alice, and she encrypts it for Bob and sends that to the both of them. And then after that, that particular key can be decrypted by both of them, of course, and then they can use it to encrypt their own communication. Let's make it a bit more formal. Alice sends something in the beginning. She sends her own identity, and she sends the identity of herself and Bob encrypted. Yeah, why does she do that? Well, if she wouldn't encrypt that part, and somebody else would come and say, "Okay, let's change the identity of Bob to the identity of Eve," yeah, then the KDC would have no means of seeing that something happened. And I can see if something happened to that particular encrypted, maybe somebody just replaces that by some other encryption, maybe a previous recording or whatever. Yeah, but then they can hopefully decide that this is not correct. This is not secure anyway. Yeah, you need to do a lot more for security, but just as an illustration. So the KDC generates a key and encrypts that with the same with the same key that he shares with Alice and sends it back, and he sends it to Bob also. And then Alice and Bob can use that key to encrypt their communication. So instead of having hundreds of thousands of keys, if the community grows, everybody in principle has just one key now. So here I had to have 18 keys, 17, because one person left. Yeah, but now I just have to have one key. And with that key, I can securely talk to the KDC. If I want to talk to you, I'll ask for a key to use now. And then when we stop talking, I'll forget about that key. If I want to talk later again, I'll ask a new key to from the KDC. So everybody just needs one, let's say, long-term key. Maybe you want to refresh it at some point also, but the key that we get from the KDC, we'll just use that for talking here and now, and then later on we'll forget about it. Obviously, it's much easier than physical distribution. Yeah, we just need to have one key. And I'll just go to the KDC and say, okay, I want to be part of this. Give me my key that I share with you. There is more overhead communication, of course. Every time that I want to talk to somebody, I have to send a message to the KDC. The KDC sends out two messages, and only then I can start talking. And, of course, most important, I have to trust the KDC. That organization just generated a key for me. They have access to that too, or they can have access to that too. Hopefully not. Hopefully it's implemented in a secure manner, but yeah, you never know. Just as a note, this is just an illustration. Yeah, the described protocol was by no means secure. Just to have, they have the idea. Yeah, we're not focusing this course anyway on secure protocols. Questions? It's a lot of information this week. Sorry for that. Next week again. Sorry for that already. Any questions on symmetric crypto? Okay, good. That means either was very clear or very unclear. I'll assume the former. For the exercise session, the way that we'll do it from now on is that I have published something in Blackboard in the news section. I've named a number of questions from chapter 2. And all the questions and exercises from chapter 20, which is on in detail on symmetric encryption, yeah. And those are the things that you can work on now. The questions that you see there could be very typical questions that you get on an exam. So, exercising with them, having an idea how to answer them, that would be a good exercise for getting to know what kind of questions you get on the exam. Yeah, so I very much hope that everybody stays and not runs away and says, oh yeah, 3 hours of Patrick, that's more than enough, Hade. But stay and start practicing. Marita and Kyle are here to answer questions whenever you need to have a question. If there is something that they will notice that everybody is asking me the same question, at some point we'll then answer that on the whiteboard, so everybody knows. Yeah, but hopefully that will not be needed. Yeah? Questions? You are allowed to ask questions, by the way. Okay, then Marita and Kyle are here already, so you either can get started. We only had a very short break, so if you want to get some food or whatever, that's possible too. For the people that are online and the ones that can't come to class, please remember that there is the office hours of the teaching assistants. So today, between 6 and 7, Kyle is at Skype, and he can answer any questions. Monday, same time, between 6 and 7, it is Marita. So they can answer questions then. Unfortunately, for myself, I answer also questions if you send them, but I'll try to reduce that. Okay. Thanks for now then.